Ephesians 5, beginning in verse 22. Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its Savior. Now as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit in everything to their husbands. Verse 25. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ does the church, because we are members of his body. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is profound, and I am saying that it refers to Christ and the church. However, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. And you can be seated. Well, this morning we're going to continue to look at what most people call the household code of the book of Ephesians. And it's really God's plan for how the Christian home is to work and to operate. And our attention this morning turns to the role of husbands. We've seen in verses 22 through 24 that wives are to submit to their husbands as to Jesus. We spent a couple weeks on that. That was the main command of verses 22 through 24, was that wives submit to husbands. This morning, we see that the main command for husbands is to love their wives. Husbands, love your wives. That's verse 25. And just a little side note, I feel the need to make this clear. When I say husbands love wives or wives submit to husbands, we are not in any way endorsing polygamous marriage or polyamorous marriage. We're not. I shouldn't have to say that, but sadly, we live in a day where this needs to be said. I was actually listening to the podcast, The Briefing. It's Al Mohler's podcast. I've commended it to you in the past, and he actually spent half an episode this week talking about how in Brazil, the Brazilian government is playing around with polyamorous relationships, and that threesomes are now a thing, and they're the next thing in the sexual revolution. And did you know that in 1895, in order for Utah to become a state in the Union, they had to outlaw, ban forever into perpetuity polygamous relationships? That was part of the deal for them to even become a union. Well, the degeneracy in our society is so bad that we have to push back against not just adultery and homosexuality, but all kinds of sexual deviances. So I don't think anybody misunderstood me, but or Paul, really, because I'm just quoting Paul here, but when I say wives submit to husbands or husbands love wives, this is not endorsing any of that. Marriage is between one man, one woman, for life, the end. So I'm glad we're all on the same page. That was for free. This morning, we come to the husbands, and just as the main command, as I mentioned before, to wives was to submit to their husbands as to the Lord, the main command here is love. Husbands, you are called to love your wives. And in this little section, verses 25 through 33, eight verses, the word love is used eight times. It is the controlling verb of the entire passage. It is the main thing. The main thrust is in verse 25, and then the rest of the passage is actually fleshing out exactly what that looks like. What does Christian love from a husband to a wife look like? Now, I just want to say the command to love our wives might seem a little bit odd here because Paul just told wives to submit to their own husbands. So if wives are called to submit, why aren't husbands called to lead? Why aren't husbands called to take charge? I think it's actually a glaring omission here that husbands are never commanded to lead their wives. Added to that, I think, is the irony that when most people talk about this section, they usually talk about it in terms of husbands leading their wives. I don't know if you've talked to people or maybe you said that yourself. Excuse me, but there's no mention at all of leadership or taking charge. In fact, in the three main areas of the household code in the New Testament, here, Colossians and 1 Peter, there's no mention of husbands, lead your wives anywhere. It's just not there. Colossians 3:19 says, husbands, love your wives and do not be harsh with them. That's it. That's the whole command. Love. And fellas, don't be mean. That's Paul's admonition. No mention of leadership. 1 Peter 3:7, likewise, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way, showing honor to the woman as the weaker vessel, since they are heirs with you of the grace of life, so that your prayers may not be hindered. So the main command that Peter gives to husbands is live with your wives in an understanding way. That's what you're to do. There's no mention of leadership. So just live in an understanding way. Stop being a jerk. And he describes how and why. So the obvious question here is, are husbands to lead in the home? Are they to lead in the home? Or are the egalitarians and the feminists right? And, you know, we're just all equal in every way. And you know, it's 50-50. There's no roles. There's no hierarchy. Well, let me tell you, they're not right at all in any way. I know you guys are shocked that I would say such a thing. But they're not. There is a call of husbands to lead. And what I want to do this morning is I want to kind of step back, sort of like what we did with wives a couple of weeks ago. And I want to spend most of our time talking about what the role of men, but husbands specifically, what the role of men is in God's design in general. And then I want to spend a little bit of time talking about the command for husbands to love your wives. We'll do that toward the end. And then we'll really unpack this passage next week. So let's talk about God's design for men in general. And this is important, men, because if you don't know what you're doing here on this earth in terms of leading in every area of life, you're not going to be effective for what God has called you to do. If you don't understand that God has called you to lead, then things are going to get very muddy, very confusing in a lot of different ways. God has designed men specifically to lead. And if you don't know that, if you don't know that that is God's design for your life, then things are going to get wrong. Just as a by way of a simple illustration, I have a hammer that my dad gave me. And this hammer, it's amazing. It's the perfect size, perfect weight. It just swings so well. But the back of the hammer doesn't have the little claws. It has like this little, it's almost like a hatchet thing. And I had no idea what this thing was for the longest time. And, you know, so we're up doing a roof. And my son and I were talking about this thing. And we take a picture of it and upload it to ChatGPT and say, you know, what is this hammer for? You know what the hammer's for? It's for a cedar roof. That's what it's for. It's so that when you're putting shingles on the roof, you can turn it around and you can cut the cedar shingles to be just the right size. But I had no idea what half of this hammer was for. So I wasn't using it to its potential. And it was just, yeah, I was only using it sort of the way it was designed. Well, the same is true with our lives. If we don't understand how God has designed us, designed men, designed women, not only will we miss what we're supposed to be doing, but we could really get things wrong if we mix it up. I mean, imagine I was like, hey, you know what? Maybe this is actually a hatchet, and I should like sharpen that edge and, you know, try and chop some wood and you know, heat my wood stove if I had a wood stove. Well, I'd get frustrated, wouldn't I? Because that's not what it's designed to do. Maybe it would chop up some kindling or something like that, but it's not designed to do that. Well, the same thing is true with men and women. If we miss the design, if we mess that up, like it might kind of hobble along, but it's not doing what God has designed us to do. So here's my big picture this morning, if you're just jotting down notes. The big picture here is that God has designed men to lead, not just in the home, but in every sphere of life. God has designed men to lead in every sphere of life. That is, in fact, the design, and because God designed it, that's a good thing. I mentioned a couple weeks ago that we are not shy about what the Bible has to say about ladies, wives specifically, submitting to their husbands, and here we're not shy about the reality that God has called men to lead and lead in every sphere of life. This is simply what the Bible teaches, and basically, to be really honest with you, what all humanity believed until like 10 minutes ago in the grand scheme of things. We saw last week men leading as early as Adam in the garden. We covered that last week. I won't rehash all that, but Adam was the federal head of all humanity, and in Adam we all sin. And even though Eve ate the fruit first and and the serpent tried to tempt Eve, it was Adam that plunged us into ruin and destruction, and it was to Adam that God called to give an account. And from there, we are called men to lead in every area of life. And you can basically break down the spheres of life into three spheres. There's three. There's the civil sphere, there's the religious sphere, and there is the family sphere of life. So I want to spend our time talking about those before we come back to love. So let's talk about the civil sphere. By the civil sphere, I mean government, the civil function of society. Well, how do we know men lead? Well, because the Bible tells us. And it tells us in many ways. First of all, the one true society that was designed by God was Israel in the Old Testament in terms of a civic society. The 12 tribes of Israel are all named after sons or daughters? They're all named after sons. We know that Jacob had daughters. You know, there was Dinah. We know there were other daughters as well. But all of his sons were the ones who were called to rule each individual tribe. They were the heads of those tribes. We see that just even in the naming of the tribes. We also see that God has commanded, in the Old Testament especially, only men for governmental roles. And I'm going to read some of these, so you can just jot this down. Exodus 18, verse 21. Don't need to turn there. Israel was to look for able men from all the people. And Moses says, such as fear God, men of truth, hating unjust gain, and place such men over the people as chiefs of thousands and hundreds and fifties and tens. All the magistrates in Israel were to be men. And just a few verses later, Moses says he did exactly that. He issued men, qualified men in all of those positions. Not all men are to lead society in the same way. There are some men who are gifted to lead thousands. There are some men who are gifted to lead hundreds or fifties or tens. That's fine. Some men are gifted to lead in the U.S. House of Representatives. Some men on the board of their HOA or their water district or whatever. But the idea is the same. It is to be the men who lead. We see this all over the Bible. We also see it in Deuteronomy chapter 1, verses 13 through 15. Moses says they appointed wise, understanding, experienced men over their tribes. That's who ruled each individual tribe. The civic leaders were all men who were qualified. Well, qualification is a little loose. If you read the Old Testament, some of them were very much not qualified, but should have been qualified for those positions. The judicial arm of Israel, what we would call the judges, were also all men. Deuteronomy 16, 18, God tells Moses to appoint judges in all the towns of Israel. And the language indicates in the Hebrew that these are all masculine. And all the evidence that we have in the Bible is that those who presided as judicial officers were in fact men. There were no women judicial officers or elders anywhere in Israel, in the sense of the judicial magistrate. So justice, as performed by judges and elders, were uniformly men. But some will say, well, yeah, but speaking of judges, there's
Deborah.
Let's talk about Deborah. Turn over to Judges chapter 4 for a minute. Judges chapter 4. Deborah is often thrown out as sort of a gotcha argument that God does occasionally allow women to lead and rule over society. Deborah was a judge, divinely appointed to do so, so it seems. The problem with pointing to Deborah as a green light for women in civic leadership is really twofold. First of all, Deborah is the exception to the rule, and we all know that exceptions do what? They actually prove the rule. Like that's the point of it. And second, if we remember, the reoccurring theme in Israel is that everyone did what was right in their own eyes. There's really nothing in the book of Judges at all that we really want to take as being normative to society. The whole thing is a mess. The refrain is, and Israel did what was right in their own eyes. What's interesting here is that Deborah actually confronts that very problem of lack of male leadership when she's described in Judges chapter 4. So take a look, Judges chapter 4, verses 4 through 10, we see her and another man named Barak. Verse 4, now Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lippidoth, was judging Israel at the time. She used to sit under the palm of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim, and the people of Israel came up to her for judgment. She sent and summoned Barak, the son of Abinoam, from Kadesh Naphtali, and said to him, "Has not Yahweh, the God of Israel, commanded you, 'Go, gather your men at Mount Tabor, taking 10,000 from the people of Naphtali and the people of Zebulun. And I will draw out Sisera, the general of Jabin's army, to meet you by the river Kishon with his chariots and his troops, and I will give him into your hand.' Barak said to her, 'If you will go with me, I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go.' And she said, 'I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, the road on which you are going will not lead to your glory, for Yahweh will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman.' Then Deborah arose and went with Barak to Kadesh. And Barak called out Zebulun and Naphtali to Kadesh, and 10,000 men went up at his heels, and Deborah went with him." So here's Barak, and he says, "Yeah, I'll go into battle, but I will only go into battle, Deborah, if you come with me." Not good. We often will think, well, you know, okay, that's fine. But actually, this is really weak and pathetic. This is really bad. Deborah shames him. She actually says, "Listen, in this battle, a woman will get glory. It's not for women to go to battle. That's not the design. It is for men to go into battle." And you remember who actually defeats Sisera in the battle? Jael defeats him. And since we're here, you guys, we have to read the story because it's a great story. Okay, so look down at verse 17. We're going to read it. A little story time in the book of Judges. So Sisera fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, for there was peace between Jabin, the king of Hazor, and the house of Heber the Kenite. And Jael came out to meet Sisera and said to him, "Turn aside, my lord, turn aside to me. Do not be afraid." So he took her aside. So he turned aside into her tent, and she covered him with a rug. And he said to her, "Please give me a little water to drink, for I am thirsty." So she opened a skin of milk, gave him a drink, and covered him. And he said to her, "Stand at the opening of the tent. If any man comes and asks you, 'Is anyone here?' say no." But Jael, the wife of Heber, took a tent peg and took a hammer in her hand. Then she went softly to him and drove the peg into his temple until it went down into the ground while he was lying fast asleep from weariness. So he died. And behold, as Barak was pursuing Sisera, Jael went out to meet him and said to him, "Come, and I will show you the man whom you are seeking." So he went into her tent, and there lay Sisera dead with the tent peg in his temple. So listen, verse 23, here's the synopsis. So on that day, God subdued Jabin, the king of Canaan, before the people of Israel, and the hand of the people of Israel pressed harder and harder against Jabin, the king of Canaan, until they destroyed Jabin, the king of Canaan. And then they sing a song about it. That's what chapter 5 is all about, is the routing of Sisera and this army. So here's the question. Can God use a woman to get glory when all the men abdicate their responsibility? The answer is yes. Is that the design? No, it's not. No, it's not. It was shameful for Barak to abdicate his role. It was shameful for all the men in Israel to abdicate their role. And Deborah even calls them out on it. It's for men to battle. It's for men to protect. That's the responsibility that God has entrusted us with. And Israel was so backwards that men were abdicating their role to lead and women got glory in battle. So we see the 12 tribes are named after men. Civic leaders are all called to be men. And on this theme, the Israelite army was to all be men. The Israelite army was to all be men. Turn back to Deuteronomy, just a couple of books back. Deuteronomy chapter 20. There are many places that we could look concerning this. You look at Numbers chapter 1, Numbers 26. They confirm that the army was all men. Deuteronomy 23 gives purity requirements for the military, and the requirements are all for men. I don't know if you guys have ever watched the Marvel comic universe movies or whatever, and I know it's all fake, but the fakest of all of it, for me, really, is the character Black Widow, who's like 5'2", and maybe like 105 pounds. And she's like taking out dudes that are 260 pounds. And she's not like specially enhanced. Like I can buy into like the Hulk and like Thor and like all these guys or whatever. But like that's just like a bridge too far for me. Like it's just not possible. Like God has made men and women physically different. Just physically different. I don't know if you saw like making its rounds on social media. Like our Secretary of War benched press yesterday. Did you see that? He bench pressed 315 pounds. That's massive. That's massive. When you're going into battle, you need dudes. You need strong guys. That's what God has called the men to do. I can't bench press 315 pounds. But that's a lot of weight. But that's the role of men, because men are just built stronger than women. It's not a dig on women. God has designed you to be smaller and helper. That's fine. But military service, all that to say, military service has always been for able-bodied men. And Deuteronomy 20 shows us that and gives us some actually interesting, generous exemptions for men who weren't prepared for battle. God's like, listen, it's going to be men. Men are going to go battle. But hey, listen, I'm on your side. And if you need to step out of battle for a little bit, it's fine because I got you anyway. So look at this. Deuteronomy 20, verse 1, when you go out to war against your enemies and see horses and chariots and an army larger than your own, you shall not be afraid of them. For Yahweh your God is with you, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And when you draw near to the battle, the priest shall come forward and speak to the people and shall say to them, "Hear, O Israel, today you are drawing near for battle against your enemies. Let not your heart faint. Do not fear or panic or be in dread of them." Have no fear at all. Verse 4, "For the Lord your God is he who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies and to give you the victory." Then the officer shall speak to the people, saying, "Is there any man who has built a new house and has not dedicated it? Did you build a home? Stay at home. And is there any man who has planted a vineyard and has not enjoyed its fruit? Let him go back to his house, lest he die in battle and another man enjoy his fruit. Is there any man who has betrothed a wife and has not taken her? Let him go back to his house, and lest he die in battle and another man take her." And the officer shall speak further to the people. "Is there any man who is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go back to his house, lest he make the heart of his fellows melt like his own." Like, don't go into battle if you're a coward. Don't go into battle if you're afraid. You're going to make everybody else melt in fear. No, go home. We got this. God's on our side. Verse 9, "And when the officers have finished speaking to the people, then commanders shall be appointed at the head of the people." But all these exemptions are given to men. I mean, and they're pretty generous. Like, do you plant a garden? Like, go tend your garden. Like, it's cool. We got this. Did you build a house? Go tend to your house. Are you engaged? Like, then go marry her. Like, go have some babies. It's fine. Like, we got this thing. Generous exemptions, but all the exemptions are to men. In fact, what's interesting, just taking a step further, the Bible talks about women fighting in battle as a curse. So Isaiah 3, verse 12, says that Israel is oppressed by infants and by women ruling over them. That's a curse. When women are ruling over them. Nahum chapter 3, verse 13, God mocks Nineveh, saying that their troops are all like women. You guys, this should not offend anyone. Ladies, it should not offend you either. Hopefully you have the wherewithal to understand that usually guys are much stronger than you are. This is just not what God has designed you to do. You remember the movie The Sandlot? When Hamilton Porter's in that argument with all the rich kids, and they're insulting each other back and forth. What's the insult that ends the argument? "You play ball like a girl." And then it just goes silent. Why is that an insult? It's not that girls can't play baseball at all. They can throw, they can swing a bat, and all the rest. It's because it gets to the obvious argument that women cannot compete on the same level as men. And again, we all knew this until like 2 minutes ago. And we all knew this until recently, when our own military began allowing women into combat, which was a disaster. That's not a good thing. It's a curse. Our daughters and our wives and our mothers should not go out to protect us. Men, that is our job. We protect our families. We protect our society. We protect our neighbors. We protect our country. That's our job. That's what God designed us to do. Men, you should be able to protect yourself, your family, your home. This is not a call to bravado, but you should be able to do this. This is what God has called you to do. Even in Israel, every man, 20 to 50, was to be able to defend the country, defend his home. Every man was able to battle. I remember several years ago, I think it was like in 2009 or 10, and it was a Republican who actually put forward a bill to conscript women in the draft. It was a Republican. And the reason he did it was a gag bill. He's like, I'm going to put this forward because it's obvious we shouldn't conscript women into the draft. You know what happened? You remember what happened? It passed. They passed it. That's how depraved we are. They actually passed the bill to force women to fight for us. I even remember talking to people at the time, even people who claimed to be conservative, and they defended it, actually. You know how they defended it? This is so wild. I had so many of these conversations. Well, modern-day Israel forces both men and women to fight in their army. Well, that's true, but that's not a good argument. There's a lot of things that modern-day Israel does that's against the word of the Lord. Listen to John Piper. This is what he says in his book, This Momentary Marriage. He says, woe to the man and woe to the country who sends its women to fight for them. Men, this is our job. This is what God designed us for, is to lead and protect and defend. This is the whole of the civic sphere, the nation, its tribes, all led by men, named after men. God commands men in governmental roles. Military is all male. One more. In the book of 1 Samuel, who is appointed to rule over all Israel? Well, it's actually two people. It's King Saul and then King David, isn't it? They're men. Men called to rule over all. Look back a couple chapters to Deuteronomy 17. The chief leader of the country was a man. This is interesting. This is in Deuteronomy 17. This is actually 400 years before Saul was anointed. God had actually put commands in the Bible for a king. It was supposed to be a theocracy, but God knew that eventually it would transition into a monarchy. But look here, Deuteronomy 17, verses 14 through 20. He says, when you come to the land that the Lord your God is giving you, and you possess it, and you dwell in it, and you say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me, you may indeed set a king over you, whom Yahweh your God will choose. One from among your brothers you shall set as king over you. You may not put a foreigner over you who is not your brother, only he must not acquire many horses for himself, or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses, since the Lord has said, you shall never return that way again. And he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold. And when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself in a book a copy of this law approved by the Levitical priests. And it shall be with him, and he shall read it in all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear Yahweh his God by keeping all the words of the law and these statutes and doing them, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brothers, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment either to the right hand or to the left, so that he may continue long in his kingdom, he and his children in Israel. So the rulers of Israel are all to be kings. They are men. They're often very fallen men, wicked men, especially Israel in the north. Never had a good king, never had a God-honoring king, Israel in the north. But they were all to be men. Men were designed by God to rule. Now, how do we apply this? I would just say, men, God has designed you to lead in the civic realm. Maybe not everyone, and maybe not all in the same way, but I think we need to consider that God specifically sets the standard that men who lead in civics are the ones who lead in civics and military and government. He hasn't, frankly, designed women to do that. That's not what he's designed them for. And I think men, just as some of you need to prayerfully consider, has God called you to teach, maybe be an elder or a deacon, you know, your role in the life of the church? I think maybe you need to consider, has God called you to some sort of civic action as well, some sort of civic duty as well? I think men should especially be attuned to the nature of government around us. And by that, I don't mean just bantering about politics. I don't mean just arguing about the latest Fox News breaking headline or, you know, whatever app you use. I mean actually engaged in some sort of civic action, civic process. I think you guys know I'm involved in politics, obviously. But it amazes me how little engagement there is. And it especially amazes me how little Christian engagement there is. You guys, this is easy pickings. This is low-hanging fruit. Nobody shows up to the city council meetings. Like, nobody. Like, maybe 10 citizens out of 5,100. Like, the same thing is true at the county level, same thing is true at the state level, and at the federal level. You can actually have an outsized voice in civics, in government, in actually passing laws that honor the Lord. So I think men especially, you need to consider how you might honor the Lord through that. Number two, we see that men also lead in the religious sphere. And by religious, I mean specifically in the way that we worship the one true and living God. This is true in the Old Testament, and it is true in the New Testament. Israel's worship was orchestrated by male leadership. We see this on basically every level of religious life. When it came to the tabernacle and then later on the temple, God actually commanded that women could only come so far into the tabernacle and into the temple. They could only come to the outer court area. In fact, it was only men who could come into the inner court to sacrifice. Women couldn't come in and sacrifice. They couldn't do that. And it was only the priests, who were all male, who could offer those sacrifices and who could go into the holy place. And it was only the high priest, also a male, who could go into the most holy place, and only once a year. So women couldn't even be directly involved in the sacrificial system. Interestingly, even unbelieving Jews right now still honor that same system. We were in Israel a few years ago, and we go up to the Western Wall, the so-called Wailing Wall. Only men can go up there. There's no women who can go up and touch the wall. They have their second section in the back, like with the kids. Like, it's men who lead in the religious aspect of the Lord. I'm not giving any sort of credence to unbelieving Judaism. That's not my point. My point is that even that has vestiges to today. So women couldn't be directly involved in the sacrificial system. Further, we see that the vast majority of the prophets in the Old Testament are men. And by vast majority, I mean like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of named prophets are men. In fact, there's only like a handful of women who are ever called prophetesses. There's Miriam, who is Moses' sister. Deborah, we just read about in verse 4 of that chapter. She's called a prophetess. Huldah in 2 Kings 22. And Noadiah, who's in the book of Nehemiah, was actually a false prophet who opposed Nehemiah. And probably Isaiah's wife was a prophetess. But aside from those few ladies, the Lord consistently raised up men to lead his people. And this is also true in music. This is kind of interesting. Turn over to 1 Chronicles 25 for a second. 1 Chronicles 25. The musicians in Israel were almost exclusively men. In fact, the Psalter was basically written by men. David, sons of Korah, sons of Asaph. I think for whatever reason, we often consider music to be feminine, and a lot of music, frankly, is feminine, even in the church. But worship through and through, throughout the Bible, was to be led by men, and we see this here in 1 Chronicles. Take a look, Chronicles, 1 Chronicles, chapter 25, verses 1 through 8. David and the chiefs of the service also set apart for the service the sons of Asaph and of Heman and of Jeduthun, who prophesied with lyres, with harps, with cymbals. Is there a band? The list of those who did the work and of the duties was the sons of Asaph, Zakur, Joseph, Nethaniah, and Asherlah, sons of Asaph, under the direction of Asaph, who prophesied under the direction of the king. Of Jeduthun, the sons of Jeduthun, Gedaliah, Zeri, Jeshiah, Shammai, Hashabiah, Mathathiah, 6 under the direction of their father Jeduthun, who prophesied with the lyre in thanksgiving and praise to the Lord. Of Heman, the sons of Heman, Bukiah, Mataniah, Uziel, Shebuel, and Jeremoth, Hananiah, Hanani, Elithoth, Gidalti, and Romati, Edzer, Josh, Bekashah, Malathi, Hathir, Mahazoth. All of these were sons of Heman, the king's seer or prophet, according to the promise of God to exalt him. For God had given Heman 14 sons and 3 daughters. They were all under the direction of their father in the music in the house of Yahweh with cymbals, harps, and lyres for the service of the house of God. Asaph, Jeduthun, and Heman were under the order of the king. The number of them, along with their brothers who were trained in singing to Yahweh, all were skillful, was 288. And they cast lots for the duties, small and great, teacher and pupil alike. So men are primarily in charge of music, and God blessed it in that manner. Are there women in there? Yes. Actually, there are. Are the women the majority in there? No, they're not. So women can certainly be a part of music. That's fine. We have ladies who occasionally will play music. In fact, years ago, there was a gal who played violin. It was amazing. And so we can use music to point to the Lord, but and all that to pause and say, you know, it's not that women have no part in corporate worship at all. We have ladies who do all of those things, and I think you should be involved as far as you can. But the question is simply, who did God fashion to lead us? And God fashioned men to lead us. And the same is true in the New Testament. The apostles were all men, elders are all men, deacons are primarily men, though it appears that women can work with male deacons and serve. But the spiritual formation and leadership given in the religious sphere and God's design in both the Old Testament and New Testament is qualified men. And so men, what this means is you need to consider your role not only in civic leadership, but I think you should also consider your role in corporate worship as well. If you have gifts to lead us in music or teaching or reading or imparting wisdom or counseling, if you have a desire to be an elder or a deacon, if you meet those qualifications of 1 Timothy chapter 3 and Titus chapter 1, then you really should be prayerfully considering your role in leading the church. This is what God has called men to do, is to lead in his church. If that's something that you aspire to, you should let one of our elders know. Okay, so we've seen the civic sphere, we've seen the religious sphere. What about the home? How do we know that men are called to lead in the home? Well, we saw last week that as early as Genesis chapter 2, God set up Adam as the head of Eve. She is his helper. He is responsible for her. He leaves his father and mother, though he didn't have it. He's setting a pattern. And he clings to her. And he is accountable for what she does. We also see laws throughout the Old Testament where men are responsible for their homes. Actually, it's kind of interesting. In the Old Testament, there's actually a law where if a wife makes a vow, the husband has a certain amount of time to veto that vow. He has like 30 days. After that, it's set in stone. Why can the husband veto it? Well, because he's the head. And he leads the home. We see that in family legacies, also called birthrights, given throughout the Old Testament. These were all given to men. Remember that it was Jacob and Esau were fighting over the birthright. They were fighting over the blessing. That birthright was basically, who's going to lead the family? Who's going to guide us spiritually once dad's gone? And it was between Esau and Jacob. Let's turn back to Ephesians chapter 5. I think the biggest indication that men lead their families is not actually in Ephesians section on men. It's actually in the section that we've already looked at. It's in the section on women. It's a section on wives. Look at Ephesians 5, verses 23 and 24. Paul says, "For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its Savior. Now as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit in everything to their husbands." So what Paul is saying is that husbands are, in fact, the head of the wife. He doesn't say husbands become the head of your wife. Husbands take that charge. He says, husbands, you are the head. You are the lead. And that word head, like we noted before, implies authority. It implies leadership in and of itself. I do think it's interesting that Paul does never command men to lead. He never says we need to do it. He says that we are. We are, in fact, the head. And this gets back to our nature, how God has designed us. Men, by nature, are leaders in our homes. And the question is simply, are we good leaders or not? That's what it really gets to. Are we leading well or are we leading poorly? Husbands, do you guide and direct your family well, especially your wife? Do you give her vision, indication of where your family is going, where you want to take your family? Are you gracious with your family? Gracious with your wife, like Christ is gracious with the church? Are you a good communicator? Do you communicate well? Men, do you communicate well with your wives? Or is there always miscommunication? Do you need to stop and rethink about how you communicate about certain issues, certain events? Sometimes, just to be perfectly honest, even in our own marriage, like we have to stop and go, okay, how do we want to communicate about this going forward? Because whatever this topic is or whatever this situation is, it always causes a difficulty or an argument. No. And I see a lot of smiles, so I don't think I'm alone here. Sometimes you actually have to talk about talking. And men, you have to lead talking about talking. Baby, how would you like me to approach this subject? How would you like to work through this together? Men, that's on you. You are the lead. You are the head. You have to own that. You have to guide your wives gently. I think one of the biggest causes of difficulty in marriage is poor communication. And especially if you've had poor communication for years, it's a lot of work to make it better. But men, that's on you to lead in that area. Men, do you love your wife? That's the main command in verse 25. We'll look at it more next week. But do you love your wife? Not just verbally, though you need to express it verbally. It's not the old joke, well, I told her, you know, I loved her when we got married. No, you need to tell her regularly that you love her. This needs to be on your lips all the time, that you love your wife, that you love your children, that should go without saying. But you also have to live it. When you made vows, you didn't make vows just to love her, you made vows to cherish her. There's a difference. There's a looking on your wife with grace and kindness and affection that men, you are called to do as you lead your home. Gentle, kind, loving, patient. Through every season of life, Paul says that we are the head, we are the lead. But the problem I think that most often happens in the home is that we don't love our wives well. I think that's why the command is here. What we need to do, men, is to love our wives. Ladies, you need to make sure that you're easy to love. But men, we need to love our wives very well. How do we love our wives? Like Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, because she is valuable, she's lovely, worthy of good leadership, worthy of our sacrifice. Remember, this is a gospel picture that we're playing out in our homes, and we need to live that out well. So men, let's play the role of Jesus well, that he might get the glory. Let's pray. Father, you have called us, especially men, to lead, and we want to do well. And we ask that you would forgive us when we are not good at it. You would give us a heart of repentance and a heart of change, that we would do that. And I pray for these ladies, these wives especially here, that they would be gracious to their husbands as we seek to lead. And that you would give us unity in our marriages as we seek to image the love between Christ and the church, that you would get glory. We ask in Jesus' name, amen.